Chapter 33. 9 out of 10. The Dark Friends had taken no chances with Elaine. Aside from shielding her, Tamila had taken seemingly malicious pleasure in tying her in a tight knot with her head between her knees. Her muscles already ached from the cramped position. The gag, a dirty piece of rag with a vile, oily taste, tied so tightly that it dug into the corners of her mouth, had been meant to keep her from shouting for help at the gates. Not that she would have. All that would have done was sentence the men guarding the gates to death. She could feel the 6 Black Sisters holding Sidar until they were through the gate. But the blindfold had been an unnecessary touch. She thought they wanted to add to her sense of helplessness, yet she refused to feel helpless. After all, she was perfectly safe until her babies were born, and so were her babies. Min had told her so. She knew she was in a wagon or cart by the sound of harness and the feel of rough boards beneath her. They had not bothered to pad the floorboards with a blanket. A wagon, she thought. There seemed to be more than one horse pulling it. The wagon box smelled of old hay so strongly that she wanted to sneeze. Her situation seemed hopeless, but Birgitta would not fail her. She felt Birgitta leap from somewhere miles behind her to perhaps a mile ahead, and she wanted to laugh. The bond said Birgitta was aimed at her target, and Birgitta Silverbow never missed. When the channeling started on both sides of the wagon, the desire to laugh faded. Determination held rock steady in the bond, but there was something else as well now, a strong distaste and a rising, not anger, but close. Men would be dying out there. Instead of laughing, Elaine wanted to weep for them. They deserved someone to weep for them, and they were dying for her, as Van Deen and Saritha had died. Sadness for them welled up in her again. No guilt, though. Only by letting Phelion and Marilyn walk free could they have been spared, and neither would have countenanced that. There had been no way to anticipate the arrival of the others, or that strange weapon Asni had. A thunderous crash came close at hand, and her conveyance was jolted so violently that she bounced on the floorboards. Her knees and shins were going to be bruised from that. She sneezed in the dust that had risen with her, sneezed again. She could feel individual hairs lifting where they were not held down by the gag and blindfold. The air smelled peculiar. A lightning strike had appeared. She hoped Birgitta had managed to involve the Windfinders, unlikely as that seemed. The time would come when the kin would have to use the power as a weapon. No one could stand aside from Tarmon Gaiden, but let them preserve their innocence a little longer. Moments later, the shield on her vanished. Unable to see, she could not channel to any real purpose, but she could sense weaves near her, some of spirit, some of air. Without seeing the weaves, she was unable to know what they were, yet she could make a reasonable guess. Her captors were themselves captives now, shielded and bound, and all she could do was wait impatiently. Birgitta was coming closer rapidly, yet now she felt anxious to have that bloody web of ropes off her. The wagon box creaked as someone heaved herself in. Birgitta. The bond carried a flash of joy. In moments the ropes fell away from her, and Birgitta's hands went to the knot of the gag. Moving a little stiffly, Elaine untied the blindfold herself. Light, she was going to ache like fury until she could ask for healing. That reminded her that she would have to ask the Windfinders, and the sadness rose all over again for Van Deen and Saritha. Once she could spit out the gag, she wanted to ask for water to wash away the oily taste, but instead she said, "What kept you?" Her laughter at the other woman's sudden consternation was cut short by another sneeze. "Let's get out of here, Birgitta." "The kin?" "Windfinders," Birgitta answered, holding open the canvas flap at the back of the wagon. Chanella decided she'd rather not report losing her bargain to Zyda. Elaine sniffed in disdain. A mistake. Sneezing repeatedly, she climbed down from the wagon as quickly as she could manage. Her legs were as stiff as her arms. Burn her, but she wanted a hot bath and a hairbrush. Birgitta's white-collared red coat looked somewhat rumpled, but Elaine suspected she made her warder appear fresh from the dressing room. When her feet hit the ground, mounted guardsmen in a thick ring around the wagon raised a loud cheer, shaking their lances in the air. Guardswomen whooped, too, apparently almost every last one of them. 2 of the men bore Andor's white lion and her golden lily. That brought a smile. The Queen's guards were sworn to defend Andor, the Queen, and the daughter heir, yet the decision to carry her personal banner had to have been Charles Gibbon's. Sitting atall bay with his helmet resting on the saddle bow, he bowed to her, a broad smile on his lips. The man was a pleasure to look at. Perhaps he would do for a third warder. Beyond the guards rose house banners and banners of mercenary companies, banner after banner. Light! How many men had Birgitta brought? That could be answered later, though. First, Elaine wanted to see her prisoners. Asni lay spread-eagled on the road, her empty eyes staring at the sky. The shield on her was unneeded. The others lay as still, bound with flows of air that held their arms to their sides and snugged their divided skirts against their legs. A much more comfortable position than she had been in. Most seemed remarkably composed, considering their situation, though Tamila scowled at her, and Phelan appeared about to sick up. Cheyenne's mud-smeared face would have done credit to any Aes Sedai. The three men bound with air were anything but composed. They writhed and struggled, glaring at the riders surrounding them as if they wanted nothing more than to attack them all. That was enough to identify them as Asni's warders, though not necessarily as dark friends. Whether they were or not, they would still have to be imprisoned, to protect others from the death rage that Asni's death had filled them with. They would do anything to kill whomever they held responsible. "How did they find us?" Chesmal demanded. If she had not been lying in the road with a dirty face, no one would have thought her a prisoner. "My warder," Elaine said, smiling at Birgitta, one of them.
"A woman warder," Chesmal said disdainfully.
Marilyn shook in her bonds with silent laughter for a moment. "I'd heard that," she said when the shaking ceased, "but it seemed too incredible to be true."
"You heard this and you never mentioned it?"
Tamila said, twisting around to transfer her scowl to Marilyn.
"You great fool!"
"You forget yourself," Marilyn said sharply, and the next instant they were arguing about whether Tamila should defer to her. In truth, Tamila should. Elaine could sense their relative strengths, yet it hardly seemed a topic they would argue over now. "Somebody gag these women," Elaine ordered. Casela dismounted, handing her reins to another guardswoman, and strode over to begin cutting a strip from Tamila's skirts with her dagger. "Load them into the wagon and cut away that dead horse. I want to get back inside the walls before Aramilla's people beyond the ridge feel tempted." The last thing she needed now was a pitched battle. Whatever the outcome, Aramilla could afford to lose more men than she. "Where are the windfinders, Birgitta?"
"Still on the ridge. I think they believe they can deny taking part if they don't get too near the carnage. But you don't have to worry about being attacked here. The camps beyond the ridge are empty."
Casela hoisted Tamila over her shoulder and staggered over to heave her into the wagon like a sack of grain. Guardswomen were picking up the other women, too. They wisely left the struggling warders to the guardsmen. It required two to handle each of them. A pair of tall guardsmen were unfastening the dead horse's harness.
"All I saw were camp followers, grooms and the like," Charles put in.
"I think all of her camps may be empty," Birgitta went on. "She sent heavy assaults against the northern wall this morning to draw as many of our men as possible, and she has 20,000 or more in Low Camelin below the Farmadding Gate. Some of the mercenaries changed colors and are attacking it from inside, but I sent Dial in with everything I could spare. As soon as you're safe inside the walls, I'll take the rest to help her. To add to the good news, Luan and the rest of that lot are riding north. They could be here this afternoon."
Elaine's breath caught. Luan and the rest would have to be dealt with when they appeared. But the other news...
"Do you remember what Mistress Harfour reported, Birgitta? Aramilla and the others all intend to be with the first party to ride into Camelin. They must be outside the Farmadding Gate, too. How many men do you have here?"
"What's the butcher's bill, Gibbon?" Birgitta asked, eyeing Elaine warily. The bond carried wariness, too, great wariness.
"I don't have a full tally yet, my lady. Some of the bodies..." Charles grimaced. "I'd say as many as 500 or 600 dead, though, perhaps a few more. Twice as many wounded, one way and another. As nasty a few minutes as I've ever seen."
"Call it 10,000, Elaine," Birgitta said, thick braid swaying as she shook her head. She tucked her thumbs behind her belt, and determination filled the bond. Aramilla has to have at least twice that at the Farmadding Gate, maybe three times if she's really stripped her camps. If you're thinking what I think you're thinking... I told Dialin to retake the gate if it had fallen, but it's more likely she's fighting Aramilla inside the city. If by some miracle the gate is holding, you're talking better than 2-1 odds against us. If they're through the gate, Elaine said stubbornly, it's unlikely they closed it behind them. We'll take them in the rear. It was not all stubbornness, not entirely. She had not trained with weapons, but she had received all of the other lessons Gawain had gotten from Gareth Bryn. A queen had to understand the battle plans her generals gave her, rather than simply accept them blindly. If the gate is holding, we'll have them trapped between us and the wall. Numbers won't count so much in Low Camelin. Aramilla won't be able to line up any more men across a street than we can. We are going to do it, Birgitta. Now somebody find me a horse. For a moment she thought the other woman was going to refuse, which ratcheted up her stubbornness, but Birgitta exhaled heavily. Saigon, catch up that tall gray mare for Lady Elaine. It seemed that everyone around them except the Dark Friends sighed. They must have thought they were going to see a display of Elaine Trakan's fabled temper. Knowing that almost sparked one. Burn her bouncing moods! Stepping closer, Birgitta lowered her voice. But you'll ride surrounded by your bodyguard. This isn't some fool's story with a queen carrying her banner into battle to lead her troops. I know one of your ancestors did that, but you're not her, and you don't have a broken army to rally.
Why, that was exactly my plan, Elaine said sweetly. However did you guess?
Birgitta snorted with laughter and muttered, bloody woman, not quite softly enough to escape detection. Affection flowed in the bond, though. It was not so simple, of course. Men had to be told off to help the wounded. Some could walk, but many could not. Too many had tourniquets around the bloody stump of an arm or a leg. Charles and the nobles gathered around Elaine and Birgitta to hear the plan of attack, which was simple of necessity. But then Shanella refused to change the gateway, until Elaine agreed that this time they need provide transport only, and sealed the agreement with them both kissing their fingertips and pressing them to the other's lips. Only then did the gateway dwindle to a vertical silvery slash and widen again into a 100-pace-wide view of Camelin from the south. There were no people in the brick markets lining the wide road that ran north from the gateway to the Farmadding Gate, but a great mass of men, mounted and afoot, crowded the road out of bowshot from the walls. The first of them was only a few 100 paces from the gateway. It appeared that they spilled into the side streets, too. The mounted men were to the front with a thicket of banners, but cavalry or infantry, they were all looking toward the gates of Camelin itself. The closed gates. Elaine could have shouted for joy. She rode through first, but Birgitta was taking no chances. Her bodyguard gathered around her, herding her off to one side. Birgitta was right by her side, but somehow they did not seem to be herding her. Fortunately, no one tried to object to her pushing the gray forward until only a single line of guardswomen was between her and the road. That line might as well have been a stone wall. The gray was indeed tall, however, so she could see without standing in the stirrups. She should have lengthened those. They were just a little short for her. That made this Chesmal's horse, since she was the only one who came close to her own height. A horse could not be tainted by its rider. Just because Chesmal was Black Aja did not make the horse evil, but she felt uncomfortable on the animal for more than short stirrups. The gray would be sold. The gray and all the other horses the Dark Friends had been riding, and the money distributed to the poor. Cavalry and foot came out of the gateway behind Charles, enough to fill it from side to side. Followed by the White Lion and the Golden Lily, he started up the road at a trot, with 500 guardsmen spread out to cover the width of the road. Other parties of similar size split off and vanished into the streets of Low Camelin. When the last men exited the gateway, it dwindled and vanished. Now there was no quick escape if anything went wrong. Now they had to win, or Aramilla would as good as have the throne whether or not she had Camelin. "We need Matt Cawthon's bloody luck today," Birgitta muttered.
"You said something like that before," Elaine said. "What do you mean?"
Birgitta gave her a peculiar look.
The bond carried amusement. Have you ever seen him dicing?
I hardly spend much time in places where there's dicing, Birgitta.
Let's just say he's luckier than any other man I've ever met.
Shaking her head, Elaine put Matt Coffin out of her mind. Charles's men were shutting off her view as they rode forward, not charging yet, trying to make no more noise than absolutely necessary. With a little luck, her men would have Aramilla's surrounded before they knew what was happening, and then they would hit Aramilla from every side. Matt was the luckiest man Birgitta had ever met? In that case, he must be very lucky indeed.
Suddenly, Charles's guardsmen were moving faster, their steel-tipped lances swinging down. Someone must have looked back. Shouts rose, cries of alarm, and one thunderous shout she heard repeated from many directions.
Elaine and Andor!
There were other cries as well. The moons, and the fox, the triple keys, and the hammer, and the black banner. Others for lesser houses. But from her side came only the one, repeated again and again.
Elaine and Andor!
Suddenly she was shaking, half laughing, half weeping. The lights said she was not consigning those men to their deaths for nothing. The cries faded, largely replaced by the clash of steel on steel, by shouts and screams as men killed or died. Abruptly she realized the gates were swinging out, and she could not see. Kicking her feet free of the stirrups, she clambered up to stand on the high cantled saddle. The gray shifted nervously, unaccustomed to being a step-stool, but not enough to disturb her balance. Birgitta muttered a particularly pungent oath, but the next moment she was standing on her saddle, too. Hundreds of crossbowmen and archers were pouring out of the farmadding gate, but were they her men or the renegade mercenaries? For answer, archers began firing at Aramilla's massed cavalry as fast as they could knock and draw. The first crossbows went up and loosed a volley. Immediately, those men began working their cranks to rewind their crossbows, but others rushed past them to loose a second flight of bolts that cut down men and horses like scythes reaping barley. More archers spilled out of the gate, firing as fast as they could. A third rank of crossbow men ran forward to fire, a fourth, a fifth, and then men wielding halberds were pushing past the crossbowmen still running out of the gate. A halberd was a fearsome weapon, combining spear point and axe blade with a hook for pulling men out of the saddle. Horsemen with no room to charge their lances, their swords outreached by the halberd's long haft, began falling. Men in red coats and burnished breastplates were galloping out of the gate now, guardsmen swinging to left and right to find another way to get at Aramilla's ranks. The flow of them went on and on, unceasing. How in the light could Dailin have so many of the guards? Unless... Burn the woman. She must have scooped up the half-trained men. Well, half-trained or not, they would be anointed in blood today. Suddenly, three figures in gilded helmets and breastplates rode through the gates, swords in hand. Two of them were very small. The shouts that rose when they appeared were thin with distance, but still audible over the din of battle. The Black Eagles, and the Anvil, and the Red Leopards. Two mounted women appeared in the gate, struggling until the taller managed to pull the other's horse back out of sight.
Blood and bloody ashes, Elaine snapped.
Conyle's old enough, I suppose, but Branlett and Perivall are boys. Somebody should have kept them out of that.
Dailin held them back long enough, Birgitta said calmly. The bond carried bone-deep calm. Longer than I thought she could hold Conyle, and she did manage to keep Catelyn out of it. Anyway, the boys have a few hundred men between them and the forefront, and I don't see anyone trying to make room for them to squeeze forward.
It was true.
The three were waving their swords impotently at least 50 paces from where men were dying. But then 50 paces was a short range for bow or crossbow. Men began appearing on the rooftops, first dozens, then hundreds. Archers and crossbowmen climbing over the roof peaks, working their way across the slates like spiders until they could shoot down into the packed mass below. One slipped and fell, his body lying atop the men in the street and jerking as it was stabbed repeatedly. Another suddenly reared up, a shaft sticking out of his side, and toppled from his perch. He also lay atop the men in the street, twitching as he was stabbed again and again.
"They're jammed together too tightly," Birgitta said excitedly.
They can't raise a bow, much less draw one. I'll wager the dead don't even have room to fall down. It won't be long now. But the slaughter continued for a good half hour before the first shouts of "Quarter!" rose. Men began hanging their helmets on sword hilts and raising them overhead, risking death in the hope of life. Footmen stripped off helmets and held their hands up empty. Horsemen flung down lances, helmets, swords, and raised their hands. It spread like a fever, the cry bellowing from thousands of throats. "Quarter!" Elaine sat down on her saddle properly. It was done. Now to learn how well it had been done. The fighting did not stop immediately, of course. Some tried to fight on, but they fought alone and died, or were pulled down by men around them who were no longer ready to die. At last, however, even the most diehard began shedding weapons and armor, and if not every voice cried for quarter, the roar was still thunderous. Weaponless men, shorn of helmets and breastplates and any other armor they might have worn, began staggering through the line of guardsmen, hands above their heads. Halberdmen herded them like sheep. They had something of the stunned look of sheep in a slaughter yard. The same thing must have been being repeated on dozens of Low Camelin's narrow streets and at the gates, because the only shouts she heard were for quarter, and those were beginning to dwindle as men realized it was being granted. The sun lacked no more than an hour of its noonday peak by the time the nobles were all separated out. The lesser were escorted inside the city, where they would be held for ransom, to be paid once the throne was secure. The first of the greater nobles to be brought to her, escorted by Charles and a dozen guardsmen, were Aramilla, Nayan, and Elania. Charles had a bloody gash down his left sleeve and a dent in his shining breastplate that must have been made by a hammer blow, but his features were composed behind the face bars of his helmet. She heaved a huge sigh of relief to see the three women. Among the dead or among the captives, the others would be found. She had decapitated her opposition, at least until Luan and the others arrived. The guardswomen in front of her at last moved aside so she could confront her prisoners. The three were garbed as if they had intended to attend Aramilla's coronation that very day. Her red silk dress was sewn with seed pearls on the bosom and embroidered with rearing white lions marching up the sleeves. Swaying in her saddle, she had the same stunned look in her brown eyes that her soldiers had. Nayan, slim and straight-backed in blue with the silver triple keys of a rawn climbing her sleeves and silver scrollwork across her bosom, her gleaming black hair caught in a silver net set with sapphires, seemed subdued rather than numb. She even managed a sneer, though it was weak. Honey-haired Elania, in green elaborately embroidered with gold, shared her glares between Aramilla and Elaine. The bond carried equal measures of triumph and disgust. Birgitta's dislike of these women was as personal as Elaine's own. "You will be my guests at the palace for the time being," Elaine told them. "I hope your coffers are deep. Your ransoms will pay for this war you've caused." That was malicious of her, but she felt spiteful all of a sudden. Their coffers were not deep at all. They had borrowed far more than they could repay in order to hire mercenaries and bribe mercenaries. They faced ruin without any ransom. With, they faced devastation. "You cannot believe it ends this way," Aramilla said hoarsely. She sounded as if she were trying to convince herself. "Jared is still in the field with a considerable force. Jared and others, tell her, Elania." "Jared will try to preserve what he can of Saran from this disaster you've forced us into," Elania snarled. They began shouting at one another, but Elaine ignored them. She wondered how they would enjoy sharing a bed with Nayan. Next to appear under escort was Lyr Baran, and moments later, Corinne Anshar. As slender as a blade and as strong, Lyr wore a thoughtful expression, rather than defiant or sullen. His green coat, embroidered with the silver-winged hammer of House Baran on the high collar, bore the marks of the breastplate he was no longer wearing, and his dark hair was matted with sweat. More glistened on his face. He had not gotten so sweaty watching other men fight. Carind was garbed as grandly as the other women, in shimmering blue silk, heavy with silver braid, and pearls in her gray-streaked hair. Her square face looked resigned, especially after Elaine told them about their ransoms. Neither had borrowed as heavily as the other three, so far as she knew, but that ransom would still cut deep.
Then two guardsmen appeared with a woman a little older than Elaine in simple blue, a woman she thought she recognized. A single enameled brooch, a red star and silver sword on glittering black, appeared to be her only jewelry. But why was Sylvie's Cairn being brought to her? A pretty woman with alert blue eyes that held steady on Elaine's face, she was Lord Nason's heir, not the high seat of Cairn.
"Cairn stands for Trakand," Sylvie said shockingly as soon as she reined in.
The bond echoed Elaine's startlement. Aramilla gaped at Sylvie's as if she were mad.
"My grandfather suffered a seizure, Aramilla," the young woman said calmly, "and my cousins fell over themselves, affirming me as high seat. I will publish it, Elaine, if you wish."
"That might be best," Elaine said slowly. Publication would make her support irrevocable. This would not be the first time a house had switched sides, even without the death of a high seat, but best to be certain.
"Trakand welcomes Cairn warmly, Sylvie's."
Best not to be too distant, either. She knew little of Sylvie's Cairn. Sylvie's nodded, accepting. So she had at least a degree of intelligence. She knew she would not be fully trusted until she demonstrated her loyalty by sending out the proclamations of support.
"If you trust me a little, may I have custody of Aramilla, Nayan, and Elania? In the royal palace, of course, or wherever you choose to house me. I believe my new secretary, Master Lunalt, may be able to convince them to throw their support to you."
For some reason, Nayan gave a loud cry and would have fallen from her saddle if a guardsman had not grabbed her arm to support her. Aramilla and Elania both appeared ready to sic up.
"I think not," Elaine said.
No proposed conversation with a secretary produced those reactions. It seemed Sylvie's had a hard core to her.
"Nayan and Elania have published their support of Aramilla. They'll hardly destroy themselves by recanting."
That truly would destroy them.
Smaller houses sworn to them would begin falling away until their own house dwindled in importance. They themselves might not survive as high seats much beyond announcing that they now stood for Trakand.
And as for Aramilla, Elaine would not allow Aramilla to change her tune. She would refuse the woman's support if it were offered.
Something grim entered Sylvie's gaze as she glanced at the three women. "They might, with the proper persuasion."
"Oh yes, a very hard core."
"But as you wish, Elaine. Be very careful of them, though. Treachery is in their blood and bones."
"Barin stands for Trakand," Lear announced suddenly. "I too will publish it, Elaine."
"Anshar stands for Trakand," Karin said in firm tones. "I will send the proclamations out today."
"Traitors!" Aramilla cried. "I'll see you dead for this." She fumbled at her belt where a dagger's scabbard hung, jeweled and empty, as if she intended to see to the matter herself. Elania began to laugh, but she did not sound amused. It sounded almost like weeping.
Elaine drew a deep breath. Now she had 9 of the 10 houses needed. She was under no illusions.
Whatever Sylvie's reasons, Lear and Karin were trying to salvage what they could by cutting themselves loose from a lost cause and hitching themselves to one that suddenly appeared to be rising. They would expect her to give them preferment for standing for her before she had the throne, while forgetting that they had ever supported Aramilla. She would do neither. But neither could she reject them out of hand.
"Trakand welcomes Barin," never warmly, though, never that. "Trakand welcomes Anshar. Captain Gaibon, get the prisoners into the city as soon as you can. Armsmen for Cairn, Barin, and Anshar will be restored their weapons and armor once the proclamations have been sent out. But they can have their banners back now."
He saluted her and wheeled his bay, already shouting orders. As she heeled the grey toward Dailin, who was riding out of a side street, followed by Catalin and the three young fools in their gilded armor, Sylvie's, Lear, and Karin fell in behind her and Birgitta. She felt no disquiet having them at her back, not with 100 guardswomen at theirs. They would be watched very closely until those proclamations were sent, including Sylvie's. Elaine's mind was already casting itself ahead.
"You're awfully quiet," Birgitta said softly.
You've just won a great victory.
And in a few hours, she replied, I'll learn whether I have to win another.